Morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
May it please the court, I'm Kevin March here on behalf of Heying Chang. If I could please reserve 2 minutes. Because the 911 call at issue constituted testimonial hearsay, the call's admission into evidence without Mr. Chang's opportunity to cross-examine violated his Sixth Amendment in Article 1, Section 22, right to confront a witness against him. Under the four factors distilled from Washington Davis v. Washington to determine whether the primary purpose was to enable police assistance to meet an ongoing emergency or to establish past events, the call was testimonial. Here, there wasn't ever any emergency, so there certainly wasn't an ongoing one.
How do you reconcile that with her opening statement to the dispatcher that I'm really scared he's making death threats on?
Fearfulness alone has never been a dispositive factor. Just because a witness is fearful does not mean that the witness is actually facing a bona fide physical threat. And a bona fide physical threat is what is required under Davis and under, more recently, Bryant. And walking through
the... What establishes this was not a bona fide physical
threat? There was no physical proximity between the complainant and Mr. Chang. He had no idea where she was. So she did not face a bona fide physical threat at the time she made the call. But I'd like to talk about whether she was describing past events or events as they were actually occurring. And she was describing past events here. The phone call where he made the alleged threats was over. She was reporting...
Well, it would have to be, wouldn't it? She couldn't have two phone calls at the same time.
But the record also establishes a significant time, or at least 10 minutes or so elapsed between the time the threats were made and the time she phoned 911. She was in the car on the way to the hotel where her mother and she and her children were staying.
Would you establish a bright line rule that if you wait 10 minutes to call the police after receiving a death threat, you've waited too long for that to be a report of current fear?
No, Your Honor. There's no need to establish a bright line rule. However,
what rule
it is.
Would you have us adopt?
Well, to consider that as a factor for why she was reporting past events rather than events as they were occurring. And to go back to Your Honor's earlier question, no, I mean, in another 911 call cases, you can hear the defendant in the background yelling angrily. For example, the case that the state relies on, Reed, that's what happened. So there are 911 calls where the...
Would we have a different result then if... someone else in the car had called and she held the phone up to the other phone?
No, Your Honor, because still there was no bona fide physical threat here. And no reasonable listener, which is the second factor under the Davis case, no reasonable listener to the call would conclude that there was an ongoing emergency that required help. It's an objective inquiry, and the issue is whether the statements were, quote, plainly a call for help against a bona fide physical threat. That is from Davis. She was not in any immediate danger for Mr. Chang. Mr. Chang did not even know where she was. Because there was no danger, there was no bona fide physical threat, and because there was no bona fide physical threat, there was no ongoing emergency. And we would also rely on the 911 call recording itself, which we designated. It's Exhibit 6, available for this court to listen to. And if you listen to Ms. Dempsey's tone of voice, she is calm and collected. She's clearly reporting past events. She references immediately that, you know, I'm calling about a DV malicious mischief, about the ongoing investigation, and she's reporting additional criminal activity. She explains those past events as in a matter-of-fact way. She doesn't sound particularly distressed or distraught at all. And this also falls outside the Bryant case because this isn't a situation where you have an ongoing threat to police or to the public that, you know, exists when there is a gun involved.
Could you address how your client's prejudice since the count based on this call resulted in a not guilty verdict?
Certainly. So because the jury did acquit Mr. Chang of the telephone harassment, I think there's an easy explanation for why it did so. The state failed to present evidence that Mr. Chang initiated the phone calls as the jury instructions required. And that was defense counsel's argument, and I guess the jury bought off on that. But because the nature of this call, the actual main complainant in this case, it's powerful evidence that the state gets to put on in her voice expressing her fear of Mr. Chang. That in itself is extremely prejudicial. And I would point this court to State v. Johnson. It's 152 Winapp.
Is there overwhelming evidence that your client damaged the property that resulted in the conviction for the malicious mischief?
No. Our contention is there's not overwhelming evidence. It's disputed who actually committed the malicious mischief. There's no direct evidence that it was Mr. Chang. Mr. Chang on the jail calls pointed to a woman named Mary who did the call. And although the state has indicated that Mr. Chang kind of admitted to his guilt in the jail calls, we disagree. He admitted to some wrongdoing, saying that he had, quote, effed up. But, you know, he also, it was unclear whether he was talking about the actual damage to the house or taking her car or the general fight that occurred the previous night about taking her car. Also, Your Honor, this case...
If what you say is true, why does he spend so much time in that call talking about the fact that he bought all of the things that were damaged and so suggesting they were his to destroy?
Our take on that is that he's just trying to say that he'll take care of the problem and resolve the situation. I mean, his aim actually in the call was towards reconciliation with Ms. Dempsey. But also the mens rea element that the state had to prove with regard to the malicious mischief, that it was knowing and malicious, that was in some doubt because both from the jail calls and from Ms. Dempsey's mother's testimony, we learned that Mr. Chang was extremely ill the night before, and they were concerned, very much concerned, about his well-being and health. And so because the state got to introduce this evidence in Ms. Dempsey's own words about the threats, that assisted the state in meeting its burden of proof on the mens rea element of the malicious mischief charge. And also, we would point to this court to the Gunderson decision, where DV cases, the Supreme Court has recognized that in DV situations, other bad acts are extremely prejudicial. So for all those reasons, we would argue that the state has failed to meet its burden of showing that beyond a reasonable doubt that the admission of the 911 call did not contribute to the verdict here. Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Kristen Relier, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County, representing the state of Washington. This court should affirm Mr. Chang's conviction for two reasons. First, because the trial court properly admitted the 911 call in this case. And second, because Mr. Chang received a fair trial free of prosecutorial misconduct. Regarding the other issues, I'll rest on my briefing unless the panel has any questions. Turning to that first issue, the trial court here properly concluded that the primary purpose of Ms. Dempsey's 911 call was to enable police to meet an ongoing emergency. Mr. Marsh and I have a very different take on the Davis four-factor test. Applying it, I believe that the victim's statements here were non-testimonial. She called 911 immediately after Mr. Chang had threatened to kill her and her young sons. The emergency dispatcher's questions and the answers were focused on finding out where Kira Dempsey was located, whether the defendant knew it, and how to get a hold of her. The dispatcher did not ask for details about exactly what was said in the death threats, nor did the dispatcher follow up, or would you expect a dispatcher to follow up about the vandalism that had happened earlier that day or the stolen car. Based on the circumstances here, a reasonable listener would conclude that Mr. Chang posed a bona fide physical threat to Ms. Dempsey and her children. It had just been.
How do we decide if something poses a bona fide physical threat?
You look at the circumstances, and it's clearly an objective test. The Supreme Court precedent in Bryant and then following up in Ohio v. Clark makes very clear that this is an objective inquiry. And when you look at it and you consider that Mr. Chang just hours earlier had trashed every single room in Ms. Dempsey's home, including her baby's crib, rendering it unusable by tearing out the slats of the crib so that there were gaping holes and smashing her baby's picture, and then hours later threatened to kill her and her one-year-old and four-year-old son, objectively, a reasonable listener would be concerned that he posed a threat. I understand that when she made that phone call, she was in a hotel room, but she was using her cell phone, and presumably that cell phone could be tracked. Additionally, the crime here is felony telephone harassment, so the nature of it is an ongoing threat. Unlike an assault case, which is what we had in Davis or in the Reed case, where the harm ends with the defendant's final blow, the last hit, here the harm is ongoing. It's a future threat. Mr. Chang might not have known exactly where she was that night, but he knew how to find her. He was her fiance. He certainly knew where she lived. Presumably he knew where she worked and where her children went to daycare. Additionally, I would note that in the 911 phone call, when the emergency operator is trying to reassure Ms. Dempsey and tell her, well, it's good that he doesn't know where you are, she follows up with a spontaneous, non-responsive statement of, I'm scared he's going to kill me. And the operator continues and says, okay, as long as he doesn't know where you're at right now. She's not convinced. She insists, but he threatened me and my children. Objectively looking at these actual statements, a reasonable listener would find that Mr. Chang posed a bona fide physical threat. Finally, I would just note that this wasn't an informal setting. She's calling on her cell phone from a hotel room. It's not in a station house. Alternatively, any error here was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. We know that because the jury acquitted Mr. Chang of the crime that Ms. Dempsey was calling to get help about, the telephone harassment.
What about the argument, though, that this shows the mens rea for the earlier event or supports that finding?
I don't think that it does. Defense counsel had noted in his brief that there's damaging propensity evidence in this phone call. But that evidence was already before the jury in Leslie Dempsey. That was the victim's mom who testified at RP 131 and 132. She testified that she overheard the death threat as Mr. Chang was making it in the car because Kira, the victim, put her phone on speaker, and she heard Mr. Chang say that he was going to, quote, hire a drug fiend, unquote, and put a hit, unquote, on Kira and her children. So that evidence was already before the jury, and certainly the jury here had been instructed to consider the counts separately, and we know they did because they acquitted Mr. Chang of telephone harassment. I would also note here that the evidence of Mr. Chang's guilt was overwhelming. The circumstances certainly strongly suggested that Mr. Chang had committed these crimes. When Kira and her mother left that morning, he was the only person left in the house. Her mom returns a few hours later for lunch, and every single room is turned upside down. Significantly, Kira's car is missing, and that was what the fight the night before had been about. That car is found the very next day at Mr. Chang's house. In the jail calls, the admissions, I believe, show that Mr. Chang was saying, quote, I fucked up, and that he would pay and fix the damage. He also continues to blame Kira, saying, quote, this shit wouldn't have happened if you had just let me go home. So the jail calls, he's clearly admitting to having committed this damage. If I could just briefly turn to prosecutorial misconduct. Here, the prosecutor did not equate the beyond a reasonable doubt standard with everyday decision making. That's what happened in the Lindsay and the Anderson cases, but those are distinguishable. In Lindsay, the prosecutor said that, quote, one of the simplest ways to explain reasonable doubt was to imagine a jigsaw puzzle. And then the prosecutor went on and talked about puzzle pieces showing a space needle and then said if 50% of the pieces were missing, you would know beyond a reasonable doubt this was a space needle. The prosecutor did nothing like that here. There was no mention of the words reasonable doubt from the prosecutor. It actually came from defense counsel. Defense counsel was the one who objected to the prosecutor's circumstantial evidence argument and said it's beyond a reasonable doubt in the courtroom, not on the road. So it was defense counsel who actually brought that up. In Anderson, the prosecutor had, again, specifically referenced beyond a reasonable doubt and said that it's a standard we apply every day, for instance, in leaving your children with a babysitter, electing to have surgery, or changing lanes on the freeway. Again, that's not what the prosecutor here did. The prosecutor properly argued that the jury could reasonably infer that Mr. Cheng acted knowingly and maliciously based on circumstantial evidence, and then gave two examples of how jurors use common sense and experience to make reasonable inferences. I will end there unless the court has any further questions, and just ask the court to affirm Mr. Cheng's conviction.
First, there's no evidence that the cell phone could be tracked by Mr. Cheng or anyone else, so I don't think the court should consider that.
Could you address the point that the prosecutor made that the mother's testimony presented all of the same information to the jury?
We don't agree that it presented the exact same information. The actual 911 call contained a lot more information and actually implicated Mr. Cheng in the malicious mischief as well. Ms. Dempsey's mother, Leslie, she did say that she overheard the threat, but that she didn't overhear anything else because Ms. Dempsey put this call off speakerphone at that point.
How do you address, you know, your argument about the mens rea burnishing with this information, with the fact that this death threat information was already in front of the jury through the mother's testimony?
Well, we also think that the quality of the evidence in terms of the actual complainant, who's an intimate partner of Mr. Cheng, that is especially prejudicial. There are cases that say that, you know, when a wife or fiance or girlfriend gives such opinions or testimony, that that's especially prejudicial, and we would say that that's exactly what happened here. Mr. Cheng wasn't given the opportunity to cross-examine Ms. Dempsey regarding the statement she made in the 911 call. And I also wanted to address the state's argument regarding harmlessness on the considering the different counts separately. That the jury is always instructed to consider each count separately. That doesn't tell the jury anything about what to do with the actual evidence that it's presented. And the jury can certainly use the 911 call and that evidence towards the malicious mischief charge. And I guess I don't understand the state's arguments that they somehow would have parsed the evidence based on the charges. So we would ask the court to reverse and give Mr. Cheng a fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you.